you get 300 or 400, and what you realize is the pattern of nursing in the West produces far more, like tenfold at least, more periods sloughing off of cells from the uterus than is the typical human and primate pattern. And there's lots of reasons to believe that increases the likelihood of a number of diseases in women, one, for example, being endometriosis. Okay, so that's another realm of vulnerability. Pushing on, another domain where stress becomes relevant, at least with all sorts of theorizing, is the realm of high-tech reproduction, in vitro fertilization. And anyone who has ever gone through this or been near someone who goes through this, this is enormously stressful. Your entire lifestyle is dislocated. You are getting filled up with synthetic hormones that wreak havoc with mood, with metabolism. Sex becomes a timed chore. It's a very high failure rate, you spend a fortune on it, usually not reimbursed by insurance. It's enormously stressful. And thus, there's been an obvious conclusion to reach, which is stress makes IVF, in vitro fertilization, less likely to actually work. Seems perfectly obvious. At this point, the evidence for it is mixed. It's so-so. It's not one of the more vulnerable realms of female reproduction when it comes to stress. And what I can absolutely tell you is the worst consequence of recognizing that stress might have something to do with success rates with high-tech reproductive approaches. The worst thing you can do is to have your physician, have your family, have your friends sit you down and say, oh, did you know that stress can disrupt reproduction and IVF? So just don't get stressed as you go through all of this. This is like ridiculous and one of the worst realms of applying the knowledge coming out of this whole subject. One additional realm now in terms of stress and reproduction, which is you've gotten the fertilization to occur, you've got a pregnancy to start, and something that is classically vulnerable here is the possibility of chronic stress causing a miscarriage, a spontaneous abortion. Now, the possibilities of this, the mere fact that stress can cause a miscarriage, that is run through all sorts of classic literature, all sorts of novels where key points of stress, of betrayal, of infidelities causes grief and stress and miscarriage. And I could cite the names of those books if I had ever actually read any of them. But this is a theme that goes through these, and it fits. It works. In lots of non-human species, what you will see is lots of stress causes spontaneous miscarriages. In some species, it takes the form of harassment. And often a pattern that you see is a high-ranking female in some social species that's hierarchical. A high-ranking female can harass, can stress fertile, pregnant subordinates to the point where they miscarry. There's even some very elegant versions of this where the stress of the smell, the odor, the pheromonal signal of a big, scary, dominant female can cause miscarriage. So what's going on with humans with that? What's happening there? It can happen. It can happen, but the evidence for it is not very good. It's not good because it relies on what is dreaded in these fields of epidemiology, what's called retrospective data. Something bad happens to someone in terms of a disease, and it may be a disease where people think about stress, so they sit you down while the something bad is happening big time, and they say, have you been stressed recently? And it's like guaranteed that someone is then going to say, yes, I've been stressed. When people are in the middle of some awful circumstance, they preferentially remember bad things in their past, and suddenly you come up with all sorts of bits of stressful history there. And you can even show this in studies. This was one classic study where, I don't know how they pulled this one off, and you couldn't do this with human subject rules anymore, but people were given some sort of drug that made them have like this horrible stomach ache for weeks afterward. As you can see, this really is not a modern type experiment, but what happens at that point is the person goes to their doctor, and the doctor is in on the experiment and says to them, oh, this is terrible, you have an ulcer. They don't have an ulcer, they've just taken this medication, this experimental drug that's making them feel sick, and they don't know they took it, this crazy study, but the doctor at this point says, oh, you have an ulcer. So has anything stressful been going on in your life? And because everyone knows stress and ulcers, we saw a few lectures ago how it's more complicated than that. Stress and ulcers, people are suddenly coming up with all sorts of stressors that could explain why they've gotten sick. Same thing in all sorts of retrospective studies where you ask somebody at the time they've gotten bad medical news, so anything stressful going on recently, and people come up with numbers of those events like crazy. So it's very hard to trust studies like that. So what you do then is, in some cases, prospective studies, when you look at pregnant women and does stress increase their likelihood of miscarriage, that definitely can occur. One thing that you see, though, is it's a slowly emerging process. So the bias that one would have is, oh, the morning of my miscarriage, I had some horribly stressful event. That probably had nothing to do with it if it is stress-related. It's stressors stretching out quite a few days. So when that does happen, what are the mechanisms for it? And we go straight back to the earlier lectures. You're running for your life. You're shutting off all the optimistic long-term processes. You are delivering blood to wherever it's needed, those exercising thighs, and you're delivering blood at lower rates to parts of the body that are not essential. We saw earlier on one possible consequence of this is by delivering less blood to your gastrointestinal system. In some ways, you set yourself up for an ulcer more readily or less able to repair it. Down in this realm, women, female mammals who are chronically severely stressed when they're pregnant, they decrease blood flow to the fetus. And that's triggered by the sympathetic nervous system. And you do enough of that and you increase the likelihood that you are going to lose the pregnancy. Okay, so that is the realm of what stress has to do with fertilization, ovulation, thickening your uterine walls, maintaining a pregnancy, high-tech in vitro fertilization. One additional area comes in having to do with another feature of sex, one that has long puzzled all sorts of scientists ranging from evolutionary biologists to psychoneuroimmunoendocrinologists, which is, oh, sex feels good. Lots of times we take great pleasure from sex. We have a drive towards sexual behavior, pulling out Freud for the first time, a Freudian term. There's libido, sex drive. And another thing that occurs with chronic stress in both males and females, your libido goes down. You have less interest in sex. What is that one about? You are secreting all sorts of distress hormones, as we know, and two general realms where things happen. You've got all sorts of interesting parts of your body that are sensitive to certain types of tactile stimulation and more sensitive when you have high levels of certain stress, when you have high levels of certain reproductive related hormones in your bloodstream. It makes all sorts of tactile receptors in your genitals and your earlobes and who knows where else more sensitive, more responsive to tactile information. Down go those reproductive hormones, and sensitivity in those areas are blunted, and things don't feel as good. One additional piece, a brain chemical called dopamine. Dopamine has everything to do with pleasure. Cocaine works on the dopamine system in the brain to release dopamine, and you feel pleasure or the anticipation of pleasure more frequently. And what you wind up seeing then is a very simple fact. Sex, good sex, tends to release dopamine. Nobody has studied this a whole lot in humans, but hamsters, when they have good sex, release lots of dopamine. Lots of dopamine. So what happens with chronic stress? You don't have as much dopamine in that pathway. It tends to get depleted, and suddenly sex is less pleasurable. So here we have a broad overview of what goes wrong with the system. And remember that piece about dopamine, because that's critical. That is going to come back to haunt us big time when we see what chronic stress has to do with the lack of pleasure of a major clinical depression.
Lecture 9. Stress and Male Reproduction.
Well, we're here again, and it's time for more fun with dysfunctional reproductive systems. And now we move over to the world of males. What were the themes that came through the previous lecture? The complexity, the cost of the female reproductive axis, and the mere fact that major chronic stress, and this is no time for it. As we'll see, some of the same exact themes with males. And we saw one example of it already in the previous lecture, which was that business about women who do tons of athletics, women who are starving, that business about fat stores dropping down. And mentioning that business in passing, males don't do that androgen to estrogen conversion we were talking about. But nonetheless, when males do tons of athletics, as mentioned on the average male runners who run 45, 50 miles a week, for other mechanisms that we will hear about, sperm count tends to go down, number of viable sperm as well, testicular size, this theme that we've already recognized. Now, switching over to making sense of the male reproductive system and the effects of stress, it's not just pertinent to runners. It's not just pertinent to extreme exercise. It comes up in all sorts of realms. And it's the same exact lesson once again. You can do this one readily and tell the themes short term, you're running for your life, make your sperm some other time, do it chronically, and you are going to pay a price. Now, what it all revolves around is testosterone. Testosterone, this key hormone, this key steroidal hormone that comes out of the testes. Yes, you know the drill by now in terms of an axis, the hypothalamus to pituitary to testes. But the place to start is emphasizing that when you look at this version in males, it's just a lot simpler than in females. To wit, the male brain is just a whole lot simpler than the female brain, at least when it comes to reproductive physiology. Why is this the case? It's because female brains and the female reproductive axis has to do something much fancier than the male. They have to have cyclic release. They have to have things churning along, and right around day 14, there's massive changes in the levels of this and that takes some very fancy wiring. The male brain, in contrast, all it needs to do is just dribble out a certain amount of testosterone on a regular basis. It's much more of a flat level. And this is brought about predominantly during fetal life when fetal brains are either intentionally or inadvertently poisoned with androgens. You wind up with a simpler male brain. One where testosterone release is fairly constant over time. Of course, it's not absolutely constant throughout. It responds to experience. You get some guy who's facing off against his worst rival on the whole planet, and he crushes him, defeats him at chutes and ladders, and he is going to have this atavistic surge of testosterone. Will make him glow like a baboon on the savannah with sharp canines. Yes, it responds to that, but for the most part, males are these lumpen endocrine creatures. You get a stimulus like that, you get a 3, 4, 5-fold difference in testosterone levels, and you look at females and there's these massive fluctuations again, so the female reproductive system is much more complex than in the male. Nonetheless, amid that simplicity, the male reproductive system is vulnerable to vulnerable to stress in some of the same exact ways. And as you would guess already, with the onset of stress, down go testosterone levels. Same theme as with the reproductive hormones in females, like estrogen. Your testes do not know what they are doing. Back to the earlier lectures, they are not autonomous glands, but instead it's that same business, axis starting in the brain to the pituitary to the testes. So which hormones are relevant? And weirdly, it's almost the exact same hormones as in the female. From the pituitary out comes LH and FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. And since men don't have follicles, you're not stimulating follicles with FSH, you're stimulating the production of sperm. LH, luteinizing hormone, is predominantly responsible for stimulating testosterone production. Same exact deal as in females, the pituitary doesn't know what it's doing either. So back up in the brain, same hormone again, LHRH, luteinizing hormone, releasing hormone, we've got our basic axis here. So the simplified male brain and its sort of, you know, constant state of hormone release does its LHRH business, LH and FSH from the pituitary, out goes testosterone. Now the basic theme that runs throughout all of this is, you guessed it, with the onset of stress, down go testosterone levels. You take some guy and you put him through surgery, he's anesthetized, you slice into his belly with a scalpel, and within 10 minutes or so, testosterone levels are going down. You take first year male medical students during their final exams and down go testosterone levels, which you may want to take as a cautionary point if any of you males out there are pre-meds. It doesn't come cheap. Another realm in which testosterone goes down, takes a male baboon who sits there way up on top of the hierarchy and do some vicious manipulative things so the guy drops in the hierarchy, down go testosterone levels built around the stress of that circumstance. Now here's a stressor which, thank God, I have no personal experience with whatsoever, but apparently it's not fun to be in the Marines. Apparently it's kind of a drag, in fact, especially during military training. And this was this classic study, 1970, New England Journal of Medicine, looking at military officers' training during this first couple of months. And now, in addition to all the other indignities, these guys had to, like, pee into these little Dixie cups where the psychiatrists would then take over and the endocrine people would analyze the hormone levels. And back comes the finding that you look at guys during the first couple of months in the Marines, and they've got the circulating testosterone levels of like newborn babies. And, you know, you may want to keep that in mind the next time you're in a bar and there's some leatherneck bragging about his androgen levels, and just get him up to date on modern endocrinology and maybe he'll even buy you a drink. Probably not, no need to mention my name. But what we see here are all these circumstances where testosterone levels go down. So, of course, as usual, we have to ask the question, what are the mechanisms? Which hormones released during stress mess with this testicular system? And it's some of the exact same culprits as with the female system. Glucocorticoids, working at the level of the brain to decrease the release of that luteinizing hormone releasing hormone. Glucocorticoids working down at the testes to make those testes less sensitive to whatever pituitary signals are coming out. That same theme again, less messenger coming out of the brain and the pituitary, less sensitivity in the pituitary and testes to these signals. Interesting additional hormone that becomes relevant, and it's one that's now been mentioned a few times in the last lecture, for example, beta endorphin. Beta endorphin, another hormone that's released during stress, and we saw that beta endorphin has some anti-reproductive effects in females, virtually the same thing in males. And around this point, you begin to try to put some pieces together. Okay, beta endorphin, hormone we haven't mentioned much yet, a hormone that is going to dominate the coming lecture about stress and pain, because beta endorphin is your brain's equivalent, your brain's chemical equivalent of morphine. Morphine, heroin, pain-blocking drugs like opiates, beta endorphin, endogenous morphine. And of course, there's a whole world of people out there who abuse opioids like that. So you suddenly come up with this wondering question here. Do people who are morphine, heroin, opium addicts, do they have problems with their reproductive systems? Absolutely. That is absolutely the case in males and females. Okay, so we have lots of these steps going on here, doing in sensitivity to the hormone, doing in the release of the relevant hormones, and the net result is less testosterone. So at this point, you have to ask a very critical question. And this is one that goes through all of physiology. There's a tendency to be very impressed with the change in the levels of some hormone or some brain chemical or activating of some gene or suppressing of some gene or doing something rather to some enzyme. And people consume entire careers being excited about the minutiae of this and how. And somewhere along the way, you have to ask this very out-of-date sort of question that runs through physiology, which is, well, What are the consequences of this? What are the physiological consequences? And thus, we must ask the question here, what are the consequences of testosterone levels going down during stress? And you can imagine all sorts of things. Males have all sorts of problems, and aggression goes down, and all sorts of things that happen at that point, not working very well. And when you look at it, there, in fact, is a very surprising finding, which is there are no consequences of testosterone levels going down during stress. And just to prove it, my voice just cracked in a peripubescent way. There's no consequences. Testosterone turns out to be this vastly overrated hormone. You know, it's virtually superfluous. You need, like, basically a thimble full of the stuff and a couple of sperm to be in business. Testosterone really is not that interesting. You've got to knock down levels of it enormously in order to impair fertility. What does stress do? It knocks down levels, but typically nowhere near in the range to mess up testosterone and fertility. So the consequences there are pretty clear. There's not much in the way of consequences. So where are the consequences? And it turns out the problems during stress are not that testosterone levels go down. The problem is that penises go down. Am I allowed to talk about penises in Fairfax County? Okay, I just got the thumbs up from the team of teaching company lawyers standing just away from this fine dark wood set. And we're all set now to finally, so many lectures in this course, to talk about erections. How do erections work? Turns out, in a very complicated way, no surprise, very complicated way, the thing that you have to do for starters is a spinal cord. And we heard earlier on, the spinal cord carries information from the brain signaling to voluntary muscles, and that's that boring world of the voluntary nervous system doing the foxtrot, etc. That's not the part that's interesting, and you can guess immediately what becomes relevant, the autonomic nervous system. All that stuff that we normally can't consciously control, goose flesh, blushing, all of that, this is where erections come in. Now, we had a theme in these earlier lectures when first learning about this autonomic nervous system, which is those two halves, sympathetic nervous system, parasympathetic, sympathetic arousal, emergency, stress, adrenaline, parasympathetic, calm, vegetative function. And what we saw in these earlier lectures are the extent to which these two systems work in opposition. You want to activate the cardiovascular stress response, increasing blood pressure, increasing heart rate, all that sort of thing. And we saw a great example of the autonomic nervous system working in opposition. What do? You activate the sympathetic nervous system and you inhibit the parasympathetic. And in fact, when you look at the systems there in more details, activating the sympathetic sends actively a pathway, a collateral projection that inhibits the parasympathetic. When you activate the parasympathetic, there's a collateral that comes off that inhibits the sympathetic nervous. What do you see here? This is a mechanism to guarantee that you never inadvertently put your foot on the gas and the brake at the same time. So opposition there, heart function. Same thing, but with a very different twist. Same thing that we saw earlier in terms of gastrointestinal tract. What we saw was with the onset of stress, with the onset of activation of the sympathetic nervous system, you decrease activity in your gastrointestinal system. That whole business, your stomach contracts less peristaltic directional contraction in your small intestines. We got that small footnote about the increased activation down there in the large intestines and getting rid of the dead weight. But the main point there is, in this case, the sympathetic nervous system pulls off its stress response by decreasing activity in the gastrointestinal system. Parasympathetic does exactly this theme again and again of sympathetic and parasympathetic working in opposition. When you get to the world of erections, things suddenly work differently. This is the first time where there is not a clear opposition, but instead this amazing choreography that goes on. So here's the deal. In male primates the world over, you need to activate the parasympathetic nervous system in order to get an erection. And very broadly, erections come in two different flavors. There's what's called a hemodynamic erection. And what goes on there is you get an erect penis by way of increased blood flow. More blood goes into the penis, you decrease the blood flow out of there, and you got yourself an erect penis. In the other cases, it's a muscular erection. There's this muscle called the levator ani muscle. And what it does is when it gets stimulated by the parasympathetic nervous system, it contracts and up goes the penis, like during, you know, pulling up a sail or some such thing. Humans have the hemodynamic, rodents have the muscular. Muscular happens faster, lasts shorter, humans last longer, take your pick. But nonetheless, in both cases, it's driven by the parasympathetic nervous system. So how do erections and then ejaculation work? Here's what you got. Parasympathetic activity. So you've managed to turn on the parasympathetic nervous system, you are calm and vegetative, and you got yourself your erection now. So what happens next? Maybe something having to do with the social context that brought about the erection in the first place, maybe for some obscure, inexplicable reason, you begin to feel a little bit less calm and vegetative. Maybe your heart's beginning to beat faster. Maybe you're starting to breathe faster. Maybe you're beginning to exert some muscular exercise activity thing. What are you doing? You are slowly turning on the sympathetic nervous system. More time goes by, more activation of it, more heart rate, more cardiovascular, and eventually you are blasting with your cardiovascular tone. Your heart's beating fast, blood pressure, you're sweating, your toes are curling, you're exercising like crazy. Eventually you reach this point where your whole body is screamingly sympathetic except for this one lone outpost where you're desperately holding on to parasympathetic tone as long as possible. Finally, you can't take it anymore. You turn off the parasympathetic, you turn on the sympathetic, and you ejaculate. Okay, so that's how erections work. That's how erections work. And what happens during stress? What happens during stress? It's perfectly obvious. You're not feeling all that calm and vegetative. You can't turn on the parasympathetic nervous system. And suddenly, you got this problem there of stress-induced impotency. But there's a second problem that might come in. Suppose you manage to pull things off and you've got yourself this erection and things are starting just fine, and suddenly you think, oh my God, the dollar exchange rate for the euro, and something happens, and suddenly you get all anxious and you accelerate that transition from the parasympathetic to the sympathetic. What happens then is premature ejaculation. So you've got this whole world of vulnerability, and this is a world of extraordinary vulnerability. Erectile dysfunction, either you can't get the erection or you have this problem with premature ejaculation. It is incredibly easy for this to occur. Current estimates are 60% of the doctor's visits in this country are due to not organic cases of impotency, but to psychogenic, stress-related. Now, mind you, a number like that, you got to take with a certain degree of skepticism. Anytime you say stuff like psychogenic instead of organic, at some point or other, all cases of erectile dysfunction were psychogenic in nature. What does that mean? Nobody had discovered an organic explanation yet, and as one gets more and more organic explanations, the incidence of psychogenic go down. Given these caveats, nonetheless, this is a system that is spectacularly vulnerable to stress effects. So now we have this challenge, which is how to tell the difference between an organic case of erectile dysfunction or a psychogenic case. And here's where you finally get something useful out of this damn course where you, like, you should take notes. Here's where we see how you make this differential diagnosis. Okay, some guy comes in and he's complaining about how he hasn't been able to have an erection during sex in the last 6 months. And you think, well, is this organic in basis? Maybe the guy has a pituitary tumor or something wrong with his spinal autonomic projection, some such thing. Or is it psychogenic? You're trying to distinguish between the two. And here's what you do. You take advantage of a totally weird thing that male primates do, at least as weird as that business about female primates secreting a certain amount of male sex hormones. Now, this weird thing that male primates do, including human males, which is when they go into REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, they get erections. I have no idea why. I've talked to Earth's experts, penis experts, and none of them have a good explanation. Nonetheless, males get REM sleep erections. Nothing you can do about it. So here you are, you've got this guy where you can't tell if he has a case of psychogenic or organic or erectile dysfunction. Here's what you do. You give him this handy-dandy little penile pressure cuff transducer thingy, which he puts down on the base of his penis at night just before he goes to sleep, and he wires it up and satellite relays and 24-hour operators in Bangalore. And the next morning, you got your answer, which is, if this guy hasn't had an erection in sex in the last 6 months, yet 30 seconds into his first REM stage, this guy doesn't have a brain tumor, it is psychogenic. That's how you distinguish between the two. Do you still get the nocturnal erections? Do you still get the erection during REM sleep? Show that pattern and it is psychogenic in nature. So that's very easy to differentiate between the two. Actually, it's not so easy to differentiate the two if you really think about it, because you know, you got this electronic device on your penis there and it's beeping and wires and you're so sure it's going to electrocute you during the night that that's a stressor in and of itself. Here is what you do instead. And this is actually what is done most commonly in sexual dysfunction clinics, a wonderfully elegant piece of diagnostic approach. Here's what you do instead. You take a string of postage stamps and you lick them at one end and you wrap them around the guy's penis. He goes to sleep and the next morning, if the stamps have been torn loose at one end, the guy had an erection during the night. Can you believe how elegant that is? Forget, you know, electronic devices and cutting-edge tech. All you need is a bunch of postage stamps. It's wonderful, like $5 and you get a medical diagnosis. It's great. And of course, insurance isn't going to pay for it, but someday that will change in this country. So what you see here is a domain of great vulnerability to stress effects. In terms of testosterone levels going down, not such a big deal, as we saw in terms of consequence. Erectile dysfunction in terms of problems having an erection. Once you have it, accelerated transition from parasympathetic to sympathetic, premature ejaculation, that problem there. And this challenge of differentiating between when erectile dysfunction is due to some sort of organic problem, and when it is due instead to some sort of psychogenic problem. And the cutting edge thing that makes one like me proud to be a biomedical researcher, the role of postage stamps in modern medicine. So all of this is great. We have a great deal of insight now into how the male body falls apart during stress. And as we saw, probably the most influential piece of that is that business about the sympathetic nervous system has activated during stress, making it very hard to have an erection. And most of the time when you see problems with this, again, they appear to be psychogenic in nature. So this is a universal. This is how everything works, except there's one interesting case where you get exceptions, which is, you know, we've got this logic by now, running for your life, the predator coming after you, you got better things to do than, you know, make sperm, you're in the middle of some socially stressful period. But there's one area where it actually doesn't make sense to inhibit the male testicular system. Suppose you are some male moose or something at the top of the dominance hierarchy. You've just fought your way to the top and it is mating season and there are males challenging you left and right, and lots of fighting and butting of heads and very stressful, very stressful. What a disaster it would be if you have this whole period of fighting like mad, being stressed like mad in order to come out in dominant position and get the chance to mate, and you can't get the chance to mate because your whole testicular system is suppressed there. In cases like that, there are mechanisms by which the reproductive system in males are protected from that particular type of stress. Nonetheless, in circumstance after circumstance, what we see is stress of all sorts of forms, physical or psychogenic, shutting down the reproductive system. And again, probably the most important step in there is hyperactivation of the sympathetic nervous system, and you're not going to get an erection. So this appears to be universal until you suddenly find one species where it doesn't quite work this way. And it is time, finally, oh, so many lectures in this course, it is time that we finally talked about hyenas. Okay, hyenas. What's the deal with hyenas? Hyenas, spotted hyenas, have horrible public relations problems because of how all of us think about hyenas. To the extent that any of us think about hyenas, and I assume most of us do, hyenas. What's the scenario? It's one of those Marlon Perkins Wild Kingdom type scenes there where it's dawn on the savannah. And you open up and there's some carcass of something or other and a whole bunch of lions eating on it. And you get close-ups of them, you know, drooling in excitement, and it is wonderful. And then you suddenly see, right on the edge of those lions there, you see them, those skeevy hyenas, those scavengers looking for a chance to run in there and get a scrap of meat. Hyenas are scavengers. They're not real hunters. And all of us root for hunters instead of scavengers, which is pretty odd since what most of us are scavengers as we go up and down the meat aisle in the supermarket. Not a lot of us have taken down our kills with our canines. Nonetheless, we love those lions, and there are those skeevy hyenas lurking around on the edge looking for a little piece of something dead where they had nothing to do with bringing it down. This turns out to be nonsense. This turns out to be this horrible bit of, you know, urban legend going against our admiration for the hyenas. It turns out hyenas are great hunters. They're extremely organized hunters with high success rates. And the reason why people really didn't appreciate it for a long time was looking at lions through rose-colored glasses and the fact that hyenas are nocturnal predators. So you have these hyenas, and they've taken down a kill, and it turns out lions are not very good at hunting. They're big, they're conspicuous, they're relatively slow. They have a much lower success rate than you see in hyenas. What lions are really good at is booting hyenas off of their kill. So here you have the hyenas who've brought down the kill, and the lions come in and boot them off, the lions who are now the scavengers, and in comes Marlon Perkins with the film crew, and no wonder the hyenas are looking all skeevy out on the edge of things. They're the ones who were up all night hunting, and who's having the stakes now? So hopefully what this has done is pulled out a high degree of sympathy towards the poor maligned hyena, which is a good thing now, because what I'm about to tell you may wipe out that sympathy, because hyenas are really weird. Hyenas break all the rules of what boys and girls are supposed to be about. For a simple reason, not so simple, but for a very clear reason, hyenas have a sex reversal dominant system. What do I mean by this? Among hyenas, females have more muscle than males. Females tend to be more aggressive. Amazingly, females have higher levels of one type of androgen, one type of male sex hormone. Females are socially dominant to males. And here's the weirdest thing. Females have genitals that look just like those in males. They have something or other gets erect there, and they have something or other that looks like a scrotum, and it's totally bizarre. And it turns out they really don't have erections and scrotum. What they have is not a penis, but a clitoris, and they get clitoral erections, and they don't really have testes. They have these compacted fat cells that kind of look like, and it's all totally bizarre. And what it's all about is this weird androgenization of female hyenas. So you can't even tell, like, what gender one of them is. You know, as I think I've mentioned, I do research some of the time on baboons in Africa. And over the years, I've shared camp with a scientist from Berkeley who is the world's expert on hyena clitorises. Centuries will go by, and it will be impossible to talk about the subject without mentioning this man's name. He is as wise on the subject as you can get. And you would see these cases there in camp where he's like darted, anesthetized some hyena, and he drags it into camp and looks down in there, and he's got his binoculars, and it takes him a long time to say, well, I think this one's a boy or this one's a girl. They've got this bizarre sex reversal system that involves androgenization of the genitals in the female. Weird, utterly weird, except it turns out it makes sense. Which is, among lots of social carnivores out there, you give birth to a large number of kids, a litter of like a dozen lion cubs, and what you've got then is this vicious competition for food where the majority of those cubs don't make it to age one. For a bunch of gynecological reasons, hyenas only have a couple of pups, a pair of pups, and you get that low of a number and you are suddenly under big evolutionary pressure to get those kids to survive. And suddenly, some hyena, oh, way back when, got a mutation, probably in the ovaries, where they now start pumping out lots of those androgens, not the piddly levels we heard about in the previous lecture. They pump out lots of these androgens, and suddenly you've got a female who is big and snarly and muscular and aggressive, and suddenly she is the one who gets to feed her kids. You've got a bunch of hyenas who take down a kill, a bunch of male hyenas, and in come the females and boot them off, and the kids get to eat first, and you do that, that food access sort of hierarchy, and your kids do not starve to death. So here's this dominance reversal system. So where do the weirdo genitals and stress come in? As follows. In most species, among male primates, for example, erections are about social dominance. And you get some high-ranking male who expresses and he's waving his erection and penis around. Among hyenas, you get just the opposite, which is an erection is a sign of social subordination. You have some poor low-ranking male who's about to be pounded on by a female. What does he do? He gets an erection saying, please don't hurt me, I'm one of those sniffly males. You get a low-ranking female hyena, she does the same thing with her clitoral erection, and suddenly we get to the whole point of this long, pointless digression, which is amid all those species, we're activating the sympathetic nervous system, wipes out erections. Among hyenas, the wiring has to be that the sympathetic nervous system causes erections. So what we've seen here is an example of phylogenetic variability and the wonders of nature and all of that. And I would conclude at this point that anybody listening to this has to be overwhelmed with the need to learn more about the subject. So we will stop here and give you a chance to write letters now to the teaching company demanding more and more classes about hyenas. So off you go to form those letters.
Lecture 10, Stress and Your Immune System.
Well, I have just been dry cleaned and I've got a new fuzzy sweater, so time for a little Jimmy Carter-esque fireside chat about our next topic, stress and the immune system. Now, if you hang out with scientists, you'll notice they have a very irritating tendency, which is they like big words, they like complicated words, they like multisyllabic words, they like them to substitute for much easier concepts. For example, there's a stress-related disease called idiopathic alopecia areata. What is it? It means you lose your hair for some mysterious reason. Idiopathic, instead of just saying, we don't know. So there's all sorts of these fancy terms, and back in those ancient days for which you feel nostalgia, words like endocrinology or neurobiology counted as those satisfyingly long words, but in recent years it hasn't been enough. And you get even longer terms, and suddenly this is this world of psychoendocrinology or behavioral socioendocrinology or neuroeconomics or, I kid you not, something called neuromarketing. And amid all of that, there's been another multisyllabic term, a brand new field, which has emerged somewhere since the 1980s. And this one will dominate this lecture. This one has some of the most syllables around. This one is called psychoneuroimmunology. And the basic premise here is what's going on in your head, what your psychological state is, has something to do with how your immune system functions, how you fight off infectious diseases. Now, the evidence that something as bizarre as what's happening in your head can influence your immune system, something like that, in fact, goes back quite a few centuries. And the first evidence for this was this wonderful study back in the 1800s, and I wish I knew who had the intuition to do this, but you take people, back when, with a rose allergy, and you get an 1800s version of an artificial rose, probably not plastic, and you wave it in front of one of these people's noses, and they suddenly start sneezing. not because this was a real rose, but because of psychoneuroimmunology kicking in. Their immune system, their inflammatory system in this case, got tricked into starting to sneeze. Or another more recent study, another wonderful example of how this system works. And this was a study done with professional actors. And what they did was spend a day reading through a scene, practicing a scene that had some sort of horrible, catastrophic event in it. And a few days later, they spent the day reading through a scene that had some wonderful, buoyant news in it. And what do the scientists observe? Spend a day pretending that you are in the middle of some horrible, distressing, disastrous scene, and by the end of the day, your immune system is not working quite as well. Sit there and spend a day reading about some euphoric scene that you're acting your way through, and by the end of the day, your immune system is working a little bit better. Not surprisingly at all, this was carried out at UCLA, sitting there in Los Angeles, and no shortage of actors who were willing to have their immune systems fudged with, but this is the sort of informal evidence that this field, this psychoneuroimmunology, is for real. So how does this work? And especially, how does stress impact the system? Now, to appreciate this, we have to have a little bit of an overview of how the immune system works. And I know in this day and age, it's very important to do something confessional, so I will confess here, I am terrified of the immune system. I have felt that way since kindergarten because it is unbelievably complicated. So if you don't panic, I will try not to, as well as we go over the basics of the immune system. What the immune system does is protect you from pathogens, invasive thingies that don't belong in your body that can make you sick. Most broadly, bacteria and viruses. Viruses that are especially clever, what they can do is insert into your DNA, insert their viral DNA, and use that to take over your cells for their own nefarious purposes. The immune system's job is to constantly be on the lookout for bacteria and viruses, and when they spot them, to quick mount an attack. The immune system is also built around attacking cancerous cells, the starts of tumors, but the main thing they're about is going after invasive pathogens. And this is done in wildly complicated ways. What you see is, for one thing, all sorts of subtypes of immune cells that activate the system and suppress the system and activate the suppressors and suppress the actor. They come with all sorts of names. There's even like tough guy immune cells, like called natural killer cells. This whole array of different types of immune cells. Broadly, there's two categories of immune cells, white blood cells, lymphocytes. Broadly, there's two categories having to do with two different functions, two different origins. Now, the immune system, new cells are made in various places, new immune cells. They're made in your bone marrow. Some are made in your thymus gland. Others are made in your spleen, your lymph nodes. So broadly, there are these two classes, T cells and B cells. T cells originate in the thymus. B cells originate, mature in the bone marrow. Very simplified version here for our purposes. Now, what T cells and B cells do are very different things. What does a B cell do? It is constantly surveying your body to look for those pathogens. And what happens when it encounters one of them? It has this brilliant capacity to recognize what doesn't belong there. And when encountering one of these things, it starts to make antibodies that are specific to this pathogen, antibodies that will recognize this pathogen. And what those antibodies do is help to activate the T cell immune response, which is a whole bunch of these T cells to home in on whatever this pathogen is and blow it to smithereens. Now, naturally, pathogens aren't just sitting there passively getting blown in by the immune system. And just as the immune system evolved to be fancier, pathogens evolved to have fancier defenses against the fancy immune system, what might be termed coevolution. So you see all sorts of vicious tricks. There's this bacteria, this tropical one called trypanosomes, a parasite. And what trypanosomes are able to do is they keep switching proteins on their surface, the sort of proteins that B cells would home in on to make antibodies. So you've got some trypanosome protein on the surface there. B cells spot it, doesn't belong there, start making antibodies. And just in time to attack those trypanosomes, the trypanosomes have put in new different proteins. And the immune system can't find it. Very complicated coevolutionary battles. So what you find are the two basic features of what's called the adaptive immune system, the fancy stuff, T cells and B cells. Then there is this ancient part of the immune system, which refers to innate immunity. This is ancient-like bits and pieces of innate immunity have been found in insects of that sort. What B cells and T cells are about is specifying, going after some specific pathogen. What innate immunity is about, innate immunity is all about inflammation. It just kicks in any sort of infection, any sort of injury, and you just kick into action there with your innate immunity. And this is not 2 weeks later making your antibodies. This is, you get a cut, and you get inflammation there, being all set to attack any bugs that get in there through your injury. So we've got the fancy top of the line, adaptive immunity, T cells and B cells, and then we've got the simplistic first ones in there, inflammatory response, innate immunity. So what does stress do superimposed on this? The first thing that happens, which was brought up in the very first lecture, is with the onset of stress, you activate the immune system. Particularly, you begin to activate that adaptive immunity. How do you do this? Not surprisingly, you take advantage of the fastest part of your immune system, the adaptive stress response, and you take advantage of one of the fastest features of the stress response, the sympathetic nervous system. In addition, glucocorticoids in the very early phase of the stress response help to activate the immune system. And by now we see the perfect logic of it. You've had a tense meeting, your boss has ripped your innards open, dragging in the dust, blah, blah, and this is a good time to activate the immune system. This is what happens. Naturally, it is enormously complicated. And part of what you see is not only sympathetic nervous system and glucocorticoids activating the immune system, glucocorticoids also swoop in and do things like kill some of your old immune cells. So you sculpt out your immune response so that the ones that are on the scene are really critical. Some really nice work by Firdaus Darbar at Stanford University showing another thing that happens during that time is the immune response takes circulating immune cells and rushes them over to wherever the injury is, what he has termed moving the soldiers from the barracks to the battlefront as quickly as possible. All of this highly, highly adaptive. So what happens, of course, with the problem of stress when it goes wrong? Now, the first thing that happens has to do with that short-term stress response and its short-term effects on immunity. What you begin to see is sometimes an increased risk of autoimmune diseases. Now, what is an autoimmune disease? As already noted, what's going on is your immune system is going throughout your body and looking for things that shouldn't be there. Pathogens, bacteria, viruses, all of that. Thus, what the immune system is brilliant at is telling the difference between, here's the jargon, self and non-self. Self, it belongs there. Non-self, you activate an immune attack, and it's going around and it says, you know, hemoglobin, part of us, good thing. Virus, bad thing, nose, good thing. And what happens is it then attacks the stuff that isn't supposed to be there. What an autoimmune disease is about is your immune system screws up and decides that a part of you that absolutely is normal and should be there, in fact, is some invasive pathogen and attacks that part of your body. And there's a whole array of autoimmune diseases. And what you begin to see is a hint in the literature. With the onset of stress, you activate the immune system. With the onset of lots of stressors, where you activate the immune system over and over, you increase the likelihood of the immune system activating to the point of overactivating into autoimmunity. Thus, what you see is a relationship between lots of stress and flare-ups of autoimmune diseases. And where this has been seen most often in the literature is flare-ups, stress-related flare-ups of multiple sclerosis, which is a disease where your immune system is attacking part of your nervous system, where you have this autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, where it's attacking your joints, autoimmune disease, Graves' disease, where your immune system is attacking your thyroid gland, other ones as well. And what you have in all these cases is, with lots of stress, you increase the likelihood of spiraling into autoimmunity. Now, what you see is the evidence, very little evidence, that stress can actually cause these diseases, but what you see instead is that they increase the likelihood of a flare-up after you've gotten it. Not huge effects, but nonetheless, it's there in the literature. So what's going on with that? And what becomes relevant are, of course, glucocorticoids, since they come in everywhere. Glucocorticoids playing a very special role here. We've already heard they work with the sympathetic nervous system to cause that very rapid activation, but what they mostly do is something that takes a lot more time. So you've had this acute stressor, and you activate your immune system. Stressor is over with, and what you got to do is coast the immune system back to where it came from. Recovery. And what glucocorticoids play a large role in is the recovery process. Just like in that earlier lecture, glucocorticoids during the recovery phase after a stressor, increasing appetite, in this realm, glucocorticoids have something to do with mediating the immune stress response. They've got more to do with recovery from it. So that's great. But what if you've got a disease problem where you don't secrete glucocorticoids at that time? And this is an important transition because ad nauseum now we've been considering the circumstances where there's too much glucocorticoids. What if there's not enough now? And what you've got is, what if you don't get that recovery going on quite as well? And what you would immediately predict is you may be getting into trouble there with an increased risk of autoimmunity. And a number of years back, an endocrinologist named Alan Monk of Dartmouth University, a titan in the field and a man who I deeply, deeply respect, came up with a fascinating theory, which was, if you see disorders where you don't secrete enough glucocorticoids during stress, you see an increased risk of autoimmune disease. And this was viewed as wildly nutty and theoretical and implausible at the beginning. And research since then have shown, both in humans and in experimental subjects, animal subjects, that there are all sorts of circumstances where if you don't have the normal rise of glucocorticoids during stressors, the normal rise that will coast the system back to baseline, you increase the risk of the immune system spiraling out of control into the realm of autoimmune disease. So we're suddenly in a very different realm here after the endless cases where you get in trouble because of an excess of glucocorticoids. Here, for the first time, we're dealing with what if you don't have enough glucocorticoids, enough of a stress response, you are prone towards autoimmunity, you are prone towards too much inflammation. Just to mention a disease that I don't really want to go anywhere near, but where there's hints that this might be what's going on, fibromyalgia. All sorts of inflammatory pain throughout the body. Nobody really knows what's going on, but one important thing that has popped up, there tend to be lower than normal glucocorticoid levels in people with fibromyalgia. So I'm not going anywhere closer to that. This is a very, very confused, unclear, controversial subject at this point. Okay, so we've got this picture here now of, with the onset of stress, you activate the immune system, wonderfully adaptive. Not only are you generically activating innate immunity, that inflammatory stuff, but it's fancy, you're sculpting out old grody white blood cells, immune cells that aren't doing you much good under the circumstance. You're really focusing in on what's needed. You're mobilizing these cells to the injury site. All of that is great. And as we've just seen, if you don't secrete enough glucocorticoids, you are in danger of spiraling into autoimmunity. So we've got a vastly confusing point here, because what we've just seen is not enough glucocorticoids, more at risk for autoimmunity. But a few minutes ago, we have lots of stress, parentheses, probably lots of glucocorticoids, and you're more at risk for autoimmune problems, autoimmune flare-ups. This seems rather contradictory and paradoxical. Too much glucocorticoids, too little, and you've got autoimmune problems. Here's a very, very, very rough solution. And this has to do with that same point we had in the lecture about appetite. You say, I am chronically stressed 24/7, and as we saw, that's not chronic stress. Whole body burns are chronic stress. What we are saying when we say, oh, chronic stress, is a lot of those episodes of transient stressors, intermittent stressors. And what we saw with the appetite realm is that problem of you've got a lot of transient stressors and you've got a lot of periods of recovery. So what you wind up seeing is with just the right amount of these transient stressors, what you